Pop Culture Affidavit, episode 151. The Uncollecting Three. The Domination. Hello and welcome to episode 151 of Pop Culture Affidavit, the podcast that takes a look at everything random in the world of popular culture, which is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. I'm your host, Tom Panneries, and it's time for my annual look at my other blog, which is The Uncollecting. Longtime listeners will remember that I launched this project 5 years ago when I realized that I had way more stuff than I needed. And a lot of that stuff was media I hadn't even read, watched, or listened to. So I decided to set up a blog and keep track of my efforts to get rid of these things. I talked about it, as well as some pop culture stuff related to hoarding and cleaning on episode 98. And then in January of last year, I dusted off the topic for another look and decided to make it an annual thing for the beginning of the year. So as with the other two Uncollecting episodes, I have an update and some personal experience stuff to talk about, but I also have found some items from pop culture that I can look at. This time I've got a couple of articles as well as a PBS series, each of which led me to asking some questions about the nature of the stuff we have and what to do with all of it, especially when we have so much of it. And by extension, what will your family do with it after you're gone? My first stop on this tour will be the PBS series Legacy List with Matt Paxton. And I'll talk about it right after this. Stick around.
You like cheap comic books, right? Well, I'm Professor Allen, and I talk about cheap comic books on the Quarterbin Podcast. In every episode, I'll dissect a single comic from my collection, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for the issue. Forget about $4 new comics that you can read in 4 minutes, or crossover events that can cost $100 to collect. Join me in the Quarter Bin, where even bad comics are a bargain, and good ones are a steal. The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network. Visit us at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, or search Relatively Geeky or Quarterbin Podcast in iTunes. I guarantee it'll be worth every penny.
I'm Matt Paxton.
Let's do it, man.
My team of specialists, Jamie, Mike, and Avi, help me help people downsize their homes and settle estates. As the largest population of baby boomers in American history transition towards retirement, they and their families face the overwhelming task of emptying their homes to move. We help them sift through a lifetime of possessions,
bingo,
heirlooms, and collectibles.
Oh my gosh.
She's gonna love that.
To help them find the missing family treasures that mean the most to them.
Oh my God.
And along the way, they'll discover that the most important museum in the world may be in their family's basement.
Oh. I've never seen that. That is cool looking.
From attics to cellars, closets to cupboards, we uncover the memories they want to preserve.
This is living history. This is what we're here to find.
Let's go.
And discover the compelling personal and often historical stories spanning generations that are their family's legacy.
The concept of Legacy List with Matt Paxton, if you didn't catch it from the intro there, is that the host and his crew of his cleanout people work with a homeowner or family of a homeowner who has recently passed to clean out a house, room, or some other living space. The client always has a goal in mind, and it's usually prepping the house to sell, but more important, they have what's called a legacy list. This is a list of items that they want Paxton's team to locate within the house. Said items usually have a sentimental value because they are a valued possession or remind them of someone who has passed on, although they do sometimes have historical importance or monetary value. This show actually spun out of Hoarders in a way. Matt Paxton is a cleaning expert who was featured on that show, and PBS tapped him for this. But it is not like hoarders in any sense of the word. I think I've said this on prior Uncollecting episodes, but I can't bring myself to watch Hoarders for some reason. Maybe I will at a future version of this particular show. But I think that's because Hoarders and Hoarding Buried Alive are a little too much gawking and spectacle for my taste. Plus, the ones with the pets and the mold, they're more disgusting. It kind of grosses me out, if I'm being honest. Anyway, Legacy List is a mundane show. It has a tone similar to like Finding Your Roots. That's the genealogy show hosted by Dr. Henry Louis Gates Jr. As well as other shows you'll see on PBS, you know, America's Test Kitchen or Rick Steves Europe, both of which I watch pretty regularly. In fact, Legacy List is on the regular rotation of PBS's spinoff channel, Create. It's also on the PBS streaming app. Yes, I subscribe to the PBS streaming app. So I had a lot to choose from when I went to watch an episode for this show. So what I did for us today is go with Season 5, Episode 5, which is called Pillars of the Community. This episode was shot in Clinton Hill, Brooklyn. And Matt and his team were helping out Richard and Anne, a black couple who has been living in a 19th century brownstone for the past 40 years. They are downsizing and they want to move to North Carolina to be closer to family. While the house itself isn't messy, the cellar is another story. In fact, I have to say the house is gorgeous. They've not only kept much of its original look, but they have this artwork that's stunning. They've really decorated it nicely. And they had bought the house in 1981, and this is when Brooklyn was in one of its toughest eras. We're talking about the dirty New York City era of the 1970s and early 80s. Now, currently, Brooklyn is much different because of the effects of gentrification and an enormously expensive housing market. Richard and Anne not only lived in the house, but Richard, who was a tennis player and coach, founded the South Oxford Tennis Club. He even had a public access TV show about tennis. So they've been an establishment in the neighborhood for 4 decades, and now they are ready to move on. They're both, you know, they're not elderly, but they're, you know, they're getting on in years. They've essentially both retirees who want to move away. So Matt's going to help clean out the cellar, and they have 4 legacy lists, 3 true items, and one that's more of a we want to find out more information about this thing. So the 4 items they mention, at least, are Anne's father's Department of Sanitation badge, a quilt that was made by Anne's mother, memorabilia from Richard's competing in a fastest tennis serve contest, and just some information about the artwork in their house and perhaps who did it, what it's worth, anything, because they have a lot of it hanging up. So the team gets to work. Jamie, who is one of Matt's crew, is a Brooklyn native and becomes the sidekick for this particular adventure. The two rummage through the cellar and eventually find those legacy list items. In the middle of all of this, there are 2 segments about the history of tennis, as well as a history of that particular area of Brooklyn. There's also a lot about what the couple contributed to the neighborhood, particularly the South Oxford tennis courts. And they're still there, by the way. They are now part of the city parks department. You can play tennis on those courts in Brooklyn. In the end, the couple gets emotional when looking at the legacy list items, and when it comes to the artwork, the crew has discovered that many of the works they collected were from local artists and not particularly worth a lot of money, but they do represent the time that they were in the house. Personally, I think that sort of eclectic art collection where you're not collecting for money is pretty cool. And the episode ends on a nice note, which is what you want from a show like this. The crew has worked their way through the basement, and Richard and Anne know that this is just the beginning of their downsizing journey. Now, while Legacy List has a pretty culturally diverse group of clients, the thing about the show is that it runs into some of the same problems that Antiques Roadshow does. It tends to focus on people whose families have enough privilege and or longevity in the area where they are, and therefore actually have heirlooms. And don't get me wrong, I love both of these shows, but myself and so many of us don't have an American family line going back 6 or 7 generations. So many of us don't have ancestors who were able to buy and hold on to pieces that could be passed down. Many of our relatives and ancestors were immigrants only a couple of generations ago, and the next generation or two more than likely fared a little bit better than they did, even if they were living paycheck to paycheck. But as you got into the 20th century, a lot of them came of age in the first era of stuff, especially after the war. And that means that for every Lewis Comfort Tiffany lamp that someone has in their living room in Connecticut, there's 1,000 mass-produced lamps purchased from Sears in the 50s or 60s. For every piece of furniture that has provenance going back to the 1800s in Massachusetts or earlier, there's a hulking piece of brown furniture. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the term, brown furniture is a derogatory nickname for the furniture that many of us grew up with, because our parents and grandparents purchased this in the 70s and early 80s. It is, quite frankly, furniture that very few of us actually want. There have been a number of articles about this in the last few years, and they range from explaining why brown furniture has been so undesirable to declaring that it is, quote, back and that hip Gen Zers are raiding thrift stores for it. Whatever. But there have even been interior design experts weighing in on the best way to stage your home around your brown furniture. For instance, they suggest making sure that you don't go for a set of brown furniture that's all matchy-matchy. Eclectic is the approach you should go for. So look those up if you're deciding to take a giant entertainment center and decorate your room around it. But what's fun about that, and these articles about why we don't like brown furniture and how brown furniture is back and how to decorate around brown furniture, is the comments. Now, I know I always say to myself, and I say to my students, and you know, anybody will say, you don't read the comments. The comments are usually trash, but sometimes comments are actually gems. And the comments on the articles that I would just mentioned in social media posts, especially for members of older generations, are fun to read. Some of them accuse their kids in some way or another of being ungrateful, you know, with absolutely no self-awareness, by the way. Like, are you ungrateful because you don't want the burden of being their adult children, because these people are overbearing or immature, and it's like you don't want their crap, and you're actually not looking forward to having cleaning their crap out? And I realize that sounds really harsh. It's actually more of an off-topic conversation for this particular episode. Plus, yeah, you can make some of that furniture look nice if you can find the nice-looking pieces. You know, then there's also something to be said about the fact that the brown furniture of the past is also more well-built than some of the stuff today, which is composite and particle board and does fall apart and doesn't last as long. But you know, I haven't picked up a piece of furniture from my parents since I was in my 20s. It's not that I'm an ungrateful little bastard. It's just that it doesn't really fit my style. And I also live like 8 hours away. Transporting that stuff down here is a haul, literally. Besides, I think when most people think of brown furniture, they're not going to these nicer pieces that an article in like the New York Times or Washington Post is telling us to decorate around. We're going to like ugly and unwieldy. Because it's one thing to pick up someone's old end tables or a coffee table, even a headboard. The hi-fi that my grandmother used to have, this mid-century modern piece that was gorgeous, and I don't remember what happened to it. You know, those sorts of things. You know, that's what they're talking about. What I'm talking about is the other thing, inheriting my parents' giant entertainment center from the late 80s. I mean, that thing, it was a solid Cherry, I think it was. And it was from like Ethan Allen, but it was enormous. It was like the size of a car. You know, it was one of those things where it's just one big unit, had 4 or 5 shelves on the left side, and that's where you kept all the stereo components. Like, we had a receiver, a dual tape deck, a CD changer, some tapes, CDs, books. On the right-hand side, you had on the bottom a drawer you pulled out, and that's where we kept all the VHS tapes, and I'm sure I alphabetized them all at one point or another. And then right above that, like, you had a cabinet. You opened up the cabinet, and that's where you put the TV. And the VCR was on the little pull-out shelf below it. And, of course, you could shut the TV thing away when the company came over, because why the hell would you want anybody to know you own a TV? Why would you want to let your company watch TV? Oh, my God, this is why I don't entertain. But anyway, things have changed, of course, since the 80s and the early 90s. Most of these entertainment centers are actually lower and wider because they have to accommodate flat screen TVs, many of which just have their own stands and stand on top of them, like we have in our own house. But damn, that thing, it like needs to be in the Museum of Unfortunate Furniture Choices or something. It's just that huge. And if you had a Museum of Unfortunate Furniture Choices, the main exhibit, the centerpiece of it all, the equivalent of the T-Rex sitting in the middle of the entrance that you, when you come in, would be your grandmother's 1970s couch. Anyone who made it through the 70s and a good portion of the 80s, or has grandparents who never did redecorate after the 70s or the 80s, knows exactly what I'm talking about when I say that phrase. This couch had a wood frame. It had cushions that were patterned with like some scene or a color scheme, various shades of rust. Those cushions, by the way, could not be worn and they could not be ripped. I swear they were made out of the same material that was used to produce the dress slacks that my mom bought me as a kid. So the couch has its own meme. And there's a fascinating article by Lisa Hicks in the magazine Collectors Weekly, and I'll link to it in the show notes. It's lengthy, but it's really, really good. And in the article, Hicks explores what is essentially the colonial revival furniture of the era, especially the mid-1970s, when the country was gearing up for the bicentennial and you wound up seeing Eagles and all sorts of Spirit of 76 decor all over the place. My sister's linen closet, for instance, is wallpapered with bicentennial wallpaper. And that's amazing on two levels. First, people actually bought and put up bicentennial wallpaper. And second, someone took the time to wallpaper the inside of a linen closet. Anyway, toward the beginning of the article on the grandmother's couch, Hicks sets the scene really well. And the actual title of the article is It Came from the 70s, The Story of Your Grandma's Weird Couch. It's from 2018. And the first three paragraphs are as follows. They're great. And this should give you a sense of what the article is about. It really goes deep into it, but I do want to read these out loud. So, futzing around on the social media, as one does, I recently stumbled upon a meme that hit close to home. Over a picture-patterned sofa in an autumnal-colored velour with scrolling dark wood trim, it declared everyone's grandparents had this couch. Everyone's. I paused because my grandmother did, in fact, have this exact type of couch. The site Tip Hero took the meme further in a list associating this couch style with an ancient television, very similar to my grandmother's large floor model, with turned wood in the frame. The list nailed grandma's house in other ways. Bonanza on the old TV, lace doilies, tomato pin cushions, hard candy, crossword puzzles, transferware, shag rug toilet covers, and leftovers in country crock tubs. When I was growing up, grandma lived in a small prefabricated lustrum house built for World War II vets on the northwest side of Tulsa. Grandpa died when I was age 5 in 1980, so my memories of him are hazy. But the couch was a part of her home as long as I could remember. It was printed with a repeating image that might have been a rustic barn with a wagon wheel perched outside or an old mill with a water wheel surrounded by reddish orange gold and gold flowers and possibly wild fowl like pheasants or turkeys. The fabric also had a fuzzy velour-type texture, but it was scratchy against the skin, and the arms, made out of scrolling dark wood covered in more of that fabric, were hard and unfriendly for leaning against. The couch was perfectly set among the wood paneling on the wall, the dense, rust-orange carpet on the floor, the cuckoo clock, the dark wood furniture, and the heavy wood-frame TV set that never knew cable. On the side table, she kept the Sooner slag glass swan bowl and pressed glass candy jar, always filled with starlight mints in both peppermint and spearmint. When the TV was off, she loved to play country music, whether on the radio, vinyl, or cassette tape, from Hank Williams to the Oak Ridge Boys in Alabama to Randy Travis and Garth Brooks. Her tiny kitchen had a formica table and roosters on trivets and tea towels. One of my earliest memories of the house is my cousin Brian, then 10 years old, eating cereal on his Spider-Man TV tray, watching Dukes of Hazzard next to the floor furnace, while Grandma sat on the couch asking for help with TV Guide crossword puzzle clues, nibbling on a frozen homemade oatmeal cookie she had retrieved from a country crock container. I mean, if that's not a scene from so many of my generation's childhoods, I don't know what is. The article is a really deep dive into the couches and that colonial revival or mid-century modest style's ubiquity. Much of it came from the large amount of the stuff that was produced and available, and a lot of it also reflected what people were watching on TV that seemed to feel American in some way back then. Like Westerns, for example. As for its longevity, well, these were well made and expensive enough for families to try and get the most value for their dollar. You know, it wasn't cheap furniture, but it wasn't like crazy expensive furniture. So it was an investment in that sort of way. So my question is, as I look beyond the article, is, well, what do we do with it? You know, like Grandma passes on, what do we do with the brown couch? If you got a finished basement and you need a couch, I guess you can use it. But at the same time, like, am I really going to drag that thing into my living room and put it there as if it's some sort of retro piece? I mean, they are inherently ugly. More germane to this podcast, there's a sub question there, which is the collecting. And not collecting of furniture, but our collecting. And what we do with our collections, us geeks, when we pass on. And that is the premise of another article I'm going to highlight for this particular episode. It was a New York Times article that was sent my way back in August of 2023, and it came from either Michael Bailey or Professor Allen. I can't remember. I want to say it's Mike, but I can't remember. I can't seem to find the original message. Anyway, it's titled, You Can't Take the Comics With You, and it focuses on comic and memorabilia collectors who have passed on and what the family does with their things. Greg Rowan, who is the president of Heritage Auctions, which is the leading one of the leading auction houses for these types of collectibles, is quoted as saying, more times than I can remember, a spouse or child has said to me, if he wasn't dead, I'd kill him all over again for leaving me with this mess. And that is a feeling a lot of families have, because if we're all being honest, the vast majority of us comics collectors don't have copies of Amazing Fantasy number 15 sitting around. We have, you know, Atari Force number 15. And there's nothing against Atari Force. It's just that book I picked up for 99 cents. The other book is about like a million times that price. But really, while we may all have some key issues here and there, we also have a lot of mid to low range stuff that really isn't worth the eBay effort when you think of it. And a quick tangent, by the way, why is eBay such a pain in the ass? I mean, maybe it's just me who's like, oh my God, the effort to put up an eBay auction. And then I think, I know eBay has to make money, but it's like, yeah, they take, you know, but it's like you put it up, they take their pound of flesh after you sell it. It's just, hey. It's shipping. I mean, shipping's got expensive too. It's just, it's like way more mental energy than I'm willing to put in. It's like half the time I just want to take all these comics and chuck them in a recycling bin because I don't know how much I'm even going to get for some of them. I'm getting down to the point where some of my collection is so beat up because they're just reading copies of books that I wanted to grab over the years. Anyway, the worth of things becomes the issue. And that's one of the problems. It's like, you know, like I said, what is worth something? What is something that we couldn't have already gotten for $5 somewhere at a yard sale or a thrift store? And in the article, the New York Times article, a Superman collector named Carl Heitmuller Jr., who runs the Daily Superman on Instagram, talks about how he's leaving a bunch of his things to his friends and his brothers. His brother has an enormous record collection and admits that he wouldn't know anything in that collection that's worth good money, vice versa, regarding his brother and Superman stuff. And, you know, I get it, but like, who's going to do what with those after they're done? At least these two people are collectors and they know the mentality of it and they know maybe how to approach finding a way to do something with it that is better than just letting it rot somewhere. I think one of the problems, though, is that we don't get a lot of articles like that in the Times. We don't get a lot of those Collector's Weekly articles like explaining why these things are so ubiquitous. What we tend to get more of are those social media stories of once-in-a-lifetime sales of things that you might have in your house, and they don't help. I have seen a number of clickbait headlines telling me that if I owned X, then I could be sitting on $1 million. I even remember my mom sending my sister and I something about the Disney VHSs and the clamshell packaging being worth thousands or at least hundreds. My sister and I both knew enough to check the amount that those things actually sold for as opposed to what they were listed for by an opportunist who thinks he can get a grand for the copy of The Little Mermaid with the dick on the box. Most of the time, it's $5. It's a little more than you pay at Goodwill if Goodwill actually still took VHS tapes, or at least the Goodwill around me. I mean, I still sell things on eBay, comics and stuff. In fact, as of this recording, I sold the 12-issue Far Sector miniseries. That was the Green Lantern one written by N.K. Jemisin because I had it and it was in good condition. I wanted to get rid of it. As well as a portable television that my father-in-law had had. So, you know, I'm the days of making several hundred dollars in the span of a year or two are long gone. But, you know, it's if it's worth it, I'll give it. I mean, I really just want to get the stuff out of the house, maybe make some of it avoid a landfill for a little few more years. But, you know, probably also need to slow down the buying of things. For the most part, the only collectible that I still tend to buy is comic books. I have my pull list of my LCS and it fluctuates based on what I'm interested in. I buy back issues. This year I've become more and more focused on trying to complete my want list instead of just buying random stuff that looks good. I will probably buy random stuff that looks good when I go to the Baltimore Comic Con later this year because that is the, you know, throw money at it in the back issue bin type of thing. And then I can eventually weed out what I don't want out of all of that if I don't find stuff that fills a run or two. But for right now, I'll do that. And also, I have digital subscriptions. The new books are kind of a quandary. You know, like who's going to want every issue of that random sci-fi series from Image or another independent publisher that really are just destined for quarter bins of the future? I don't really want to throw them out. I mean, paper can be recycled, but like some of the other random crap, plastic, right? Plastic is not the most environmentally friendly thing, you know. Consumerism never was environmentally friendly when you think about it. My current uncollecting status is just still in that middle ground. You know, nobody's going to be coming to seek me out for a story about how I got rid of a bunch of my stuff because I still really do have so much of it. So the bestseller book about the uncollecting is probably years away. I was sitting here in my wife's office right now recording this and looking around, and my wife's got some pop figures and things downstairs. When I record other episodes, I'm standing in front of a shelf full of video games and graphic novels and, oh God, all sorts of other crap. And as I look behind me, I do have 11 short boxes full of comics, which is down a few since I started doing this. And I probably will clear some more out as I go through this year. You know, above that is just piles of things and all these board games that I've got stuff and, you know, clutter in some regard. And in front of me are just shelves of books. Like, and I look at them and I'm like, well, what do I want to get rid of? What's the piece that is worth getting rid of? And what is the stuff that I want to hold on to? Because I liked this book, or I want to reread this someday, or having it for some reason feels important to me. That's still kind of a weird dilemma in life, that a lot of these things are ephemeral and you're not always going to read and reread Les Daniels Marvel and DC books and his Batman books or The Art of Atari or my copy of 1001 Albums You Have to Hear Before You Die. But at the same time, you like walking into the room and seeing that they're there on the shelf and that sort of thing, or flipping through them when you get the chance. So, yeah. The stuff that you already have, I think, is the bigger problem sometimes than than buying the new stuff. I'm trying to buy less and less new stuff because I'm just trying to pay down debt and not add to things. So just being more stringent when it comes to that has been helpful this year so far. I've actually not reduced my pull list yet. It's more like I haven't added anything new to my pull list. And in some cases, my pull list is made up of mini series that are going to end. So it's going to naturally reduce itself, and there's not going to be, there's actually going to be fewer things to buy, pick up as I go through the year. And then if there is something that is really interesting or vital for me, I can pick it up, and add it, especially since, you know, this or that has finally faded and I'm no longer on the hook for the next issue. Movies are things that I'm not really going after except for on streaming. In fact, I just ditched a streaming service and I probably will ditch more as some of the shows that I'm watching fade into the sunset, because why am I spending so much money on the four or five streaming services that I'm only using maybe one or two? So that's kind of like where I am right now. Last year was tough. You know, I came into last year, collecting part two, and talked about how the pile struck back, so to speak. And it really, really did. And I've reduced it a little bit now, but, like, you know, when I think about last year, where it were just insane periods where I don't even think I was paying attention to what I was doing. And this is where that little mental health piece comes in. Something I'm really not going to dive into right now, but I could sit and ponder and research and write about at some point, because as I said in the episode last year where I read the two books about hoarding and discussed them, there is a mental health portion of this. And, you know, why are we so attached to these things, and why are we so afraid to let them go, or why are we so, in some cases, addicted to buying more of them? And that is worth really looking into and then applying it in some way or another to myself a little bit more. You know, maybe that's the book that I get out of this. Who knows? I'm not even trying to get a book out of this. I just am enjoying chronicling all of this. And the spreadsheet that I have is slowly shrinking, especially when it comes to the comics and the books. The visual media, not really as much. I don't watch as many movies as I had been, and working my way through a couple of TV shows, but we'll have to decide whether or not I want to get through all of them or just ditch some of them from my list there. So anyway, so that's like where I am. Again, I recommend going and checking out the Mac Paxton series. It is a charming little series that, much like Antiques Roadshow, is just fun comfort TV to watch. With the article I talked about briefly in the Brown Furniture Realm, I will link to that in the show notes. I'll also provide a link to the New York Times article, although that's more than likely behind a paywall. But at least you can see some of it. If you have a Times subscription, you'll be able to read it. As far as I'm concerned, next time around, I'm going to come back with a comic book centered episode that does delve into something in the past that I've always had kind of a fascination with. Now, I'm not going to go through specific issues like really in depth here, but I just want to talk about what I call the crisis hangover. It's that period from about the tail end of 1985 to about the summer to early fall of 1986. So probably like the end from like the Crisis on Infinite Earths 11 and 12 to Man of Steel number one or thereabouts, where you had the start of the post-crisis DC universe in many cases, but almost like the remains of what was the remains of the Bronze Age and the remains of the pre-crisis universe kind of working themselves out. And I've read, actually have a literal reading list on DC Infinite called Crisis Hangover. And I've read through a lot of the series in some way or another of that exists between Crisis and Man of Steel number one, or Crisis and Legends. So I'm going to talk, I'll give you kind of an overview and a look at that, just to see, you know, what was DC doing as they set up their new universe, no pun intended. And, you know, is this how it, what made it work or what didn't? You know, I'm not going to pass too much judgment on that, because it's just been an interesting little reading project of mine, because it was an era I was always interested in the same way I was always interested in the pre-crisis 1980s stuff, because it was just stuff I'd never read before. So come back in 30 days or so for that. Until then, don't forget to leave feedback where you can. Send me an email. Don't forget, I'm also on Instagram under Pop Culture Affidavit. And as always, thank you very much for listening, and take care.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Affidavit, which is produced by me, Tom Panneries. All clips are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. This podcast is a part of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you can find at twotruefreaks.com. If you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps the show get noticed by other people. Feedback via email can be sent to popcultureaffidavit@gmail.com. For show notes and essays and other things random in the world of popular culture, visit popcultureaffidavit.com. You can also follow this show on Facebook at facebook.com/popcultureaffidavit and on Twitter at popaff. That's P-O-P-A-F-F. Thanks for listening, and come back next time for more pop culture randomness.